Yes, very good question. The question is relating to the power, whether we would choose to use fusion as opposed to fission. Right now, fusion continues to be a very elusive target. I mean, we continue to work on it. I feel that these types of plasma rockets, which are in many ways derivatives of the fusion effort, will eventually mature into full-blown fusion rockets. That is, when the plasma in the exhaust can be heated to thermonuclear temperatures and sufficient density to produce a fusion ignition. At that point, we will eliminate the nuclear reactor, the fission electrical reactor, and the rocket will be very powerful. In the meantime, we will have to resort to existing fission power plants to deliver the electricity so that we can continue to move forward. So I see this as a progression that gradually will merge into a full-blown fusion rocket, maybe someday in the future when we get there. The question about the environment of water and space, how similar it is extremely similar if you move slowly and if you can get your mind off of the fact that you do have still gravity pulling you down. So when you work in the water, you want to move very slowly so that the drag of the water, the viscosity of the water, does not have a big effect on your productivity. And also, if we turn upside down and work head down, that is very uncomfortable and very difficult on the body, because you are supporting the entire weight of your body in the suit. Those are the only two areas which are different. But other than that, the water environment is a wonderful environment to practice these things. That's a very good question, and the question has to do with, given the power that you have available, how much really, how much thrust can you get? It, in this particular device, in the Vasimir engine, the name Vasimir stands for variable specific impulse. That means the rocket is able to shift gears. And so we can use the power with a higher thrust when we need it, and with a lesser thrust but more efficient operation when we need it. So this engine runs a lot like the transmission in your car. And when you're climbing a hill, you want to downshift so that you can have more muscle, more torque on the wheels, but you sacrifice the speed at which you can move. And that feature is unique to what we're doing. Now, the 100 megawatts with a ship on the order of 200 metric tons will only give you about maybe a fraction of a thousandth of a G. Very small accelerations. So probably not sufficient to be of any value in terms of physiological artificial gravity. But the fact that you are going to get to Mars very quickly will reduce the problem of human exposure to weightlessness. So that's how we win, because we get there fast, not because we create artificial gravity. Now, someday when we get to the fusion rocket, then we will have perhaps gigawatts of power. At that point, then the acceleration may be substantial, sufficient to give you what would be a fraction of an artificial gravity. And in that sense, you'd be able to walk around your ship just like the people on Star Trek do. Maybe not quite like that, but close.
So Star Trek uses fusion.
They do, yeah. The question is, what are the effects, the medical effects of space, including the radiation effects? There are a number of effects. The most serious one is the decalcification of the bones of the skeleton, and the fact that humans in space tend to shed their skeleton, because the body is very smart and realizes it doesn't need a skeleton. And the best astronaut is really an octopus, actually, really. Has all kinds of tentacles and able to handle, your towel and your toothbrush and your checklist and all of the other things that you have to grab a hold of. Now, we also lose a lot of fluid. In space, the level of hydration of the body tends to be a lot lower than on Earth. So when we come back to Earth, we have to ingest a lot of fluids to rehydrate the body quickly so that we don't pass out when we land. We also lose a lot of body muscle tissue, muscle mass, and so people are very weak when they come back. The vestibular system changes a lot, and so people are very wobbly, and it's like being drunk without drinking. And also the radiation problem, which up to now we have understood it in one way, but now we're beginning to realize that it's not maybe as simple as we thought it was. There's a lot of secondary emissions caused by the cosmic radiation, and so those secondaries tend to also damage. So we're trying to reassess the whole issue of radiation again. So lots of problems, lots of challenges, and clearly the reason why we need to get on the space station to understand these problems before we send people further. There is some radiation protection on the station. The best radiation protection that we can come up with, that there is hydrogen. And it turns out that that's what we are trying to do with wrapping the tanks of propellant around the body of the ship, because we're providing a de facto radiation shield. The question is the ISP. The ISP is a term which it stands for specific impulse. The specific impulse is nothing but the velocity of the particles with respect to the rocket, the speed of the particles leaving the rocket in the exhaust. And we want that speed to be as high as possible. Oddly enough, because of historical reasons, the specific impulse is expressed in units of seconds. That's because the early rocket scientists divided the velocity by the acceleration of gravity, which is 10. And if you divide velocity by acceleration, you get seconds. Don't worry about it too much. I mean, this is just the way it is. The shuttle has an ISP of 500 seconds, roughly 400 seconds or so. The plasma rockets begin with ISPs on the order of 2,000 seconds and above. Vasimir is predicted perhaps to have an ISP range which goes at the low end about 3,000 seconds, and at the high end about 30,000 seconds. So from 3 to 30,000. It's very classic of plasma. That's why we use plasmas. Now, as far as using the nuclear reactor as just a heater to expand gas, that is the approach of the so-called nuclear thermal rocket. The problem is that when you heat a gas to those temperatures, even though it appears to be very hot, it's still not a plasma. And it does not respond well to the presence of a magnetic field. So you cannot use magnetic fields to control these plasmas or these gases. And so you can only achieve temperatures of maybe a few thousand degrees at the most. And the ISP of the nuclear thermal rocket will probably never go beyond about 1,000 seconds, about twice what the shuttle has. And this factor of two is just not enough to really be worth it. So we move right into the realm of plasmas. 30,000 is what we want, and above, yes. Yes, you know, there's a lot of work in the field of plasma propulsion. I didn't really want to give you the impression that our work is the only effort. There's a lot of work going on all over the world in various forms, and the idea of using microwaves to create and also to heat the plasma is a very viable approach as well. The idea of vortices is also very interesting. The possibility of utilizing a certain vorticity on the plasma to be able to stabilize it. All these are things that are on the table, have been being looked at very carefully. No, that's a very interesting question, the electrodynamic tether. In fact, I had the opportunity to fly on both of the tether missions. Very exciting possibilities. And for those of you who are physicists, the idea is to drive an electric current on a very long string, and essentially, you know, the shuttle or the station sits at one end, and at the other end you have some sort of a contactor or some sort of electrical ball or something, and when when you do that, if you are able to drive a current through this tether, then the physics says that you are essentially creating an electric motor, of cosmic dimensions, because this is a very long wire which is moving at great speed through the Earth magnetic field. And if you drive the current, then you're accelerating the wire. And that is an interesting reboost approach, which would require no propellant. Very, very interesting. And we are pursuing that very seriously. It works only in planets that have magnetic fields, like the Earth. Wouldn't work very well on Mars. Doesn't have a good magnetic field. It would work very nicely on Jupiter. Has a very strong magnetic field. So these are all the pieces of the puzzle. Yes, the question is, what is it like going into Mir? Very, very interesting. I was fascinated by Mir because I had never been on a Russian ship before. You know, when I got there, I thought that as soon as we opened the hatch that, you know, it was going to have a bad smell, that it was going to be... This is the kind of preconceived, you know, perhaps a bit arrogant, you know, notions that we had to overcome. Really, it was wonderful. And it was pristine, clean, dry. The cosmonauts had done just a superb job in keeping that station functioning well. It felt like home. That is the one impression I got. It just felt like not like a sterile laboratory spacecraft, but more like a home. And it was wonderful to go have dinner there. We were supposed to be as shuttle crew members had to, you know, have our dinner in the shuttle. But most of us didn't do that. We basically head on over to the Mir, and maybe if we hung around there, they would invite us to have dinner, and we would have wonderful dinners on Mir. So I think I was trying to explain to you that it is a testimony to how humans are going to eventually overcome the difficulties of space flight. Yes, the question is, the plasma is very, very hot, and you have those antennas very close. How do they survive? It's almost like magic. In reality, you want to be very careful. Obviously, you don't want to have the antenna immersed in the plasma. Yet, the antenna has to be very, very close. Now, the plasma does have an effect on the antenna. So the antenna really is not bare. It is protected by an insulating piece. This piece right now in the laboratory is just a piece of quartz that supports great temperature. And it seems to work very well. It doesn't have as much erosion. Now, what happens on very, very hot hydrogen plasmas is that they become very weak radiators. They don't radiate as much because hydrogen only has one electron. And once you rip that electron off, the nucleus, the proton in the hydrogen plasma, is really non-radiating. And so it doesn't really produce a lot of heat to the antenna. So these are all little tricks. But let me not leave you with the thought that it is not a problem. I mean, we are definitely, this is part of the engineering efforts to deal with these very extreme environments and take advantage of the physics. There might be some, if we use frequencies for communication that are roughly comparable to the frequencies of the waves that we use to heat the plasma, radio waves. Typically, for these kinds of communications, we will use microwaves, which operate at much higher frequencies than the frequencies of the waves that we use for heating the plasma. So that's one potential approach. The other is that the residual radio noise that could be generated from the rocket itself present a problem, and we would have to learn to overcome these problems by suitable antennas and proper matching and clever engineering. The issue of communication when you go to Mars is less of an issue as it is in close proximity to Earth, because it will take on the order of 20 minutes for any information to be delivered, and about another 20 minutes for the response from the ground to come back to you. So it's a long time. So a cruise en route to Mars will have to be very self-sufficient. Like when you send an expedition to Antarctica or somewhere, you pretty much leave them on their own. And they've got enough at their disposal to be able to handle it. Typically when you say, Houston, we have a problem, it takes 20 minutes for them to hear you. And then usually what they say is, stand by. And, it takes another 20 minutes. So it's probably not that useful. So really the important thing is that we will have to be self-sufficient. Yes, the spaces appear to be spaces, but they really are just interfaces. The two modules have to actually mate and connect and seal with airtight closures and latches. There's a lot of hardware and mechanisms that are in those crevices that you saw in the space in between modules. And we have to be able to have access to these things, because if for some reason we need to go and do repairs in that area, we need to be able to get astronauts with their spacesuits and access that. But that is the way the design goes. All these pieces are linked together with certain spacing in between. Yes, sir. The question, are you referring to cosmic rays or you mean space debris? Space debris, just hits. We have a lot of effort ongoing in understanding the problem of space trash, space debris. Pretty much all the time we suffer collisions as very small particles that impact the shuttle and the station all the times. When you do spacewalks, you get a chance to see a lot of the impacts that have occurred on those spacecraft. For the most part, we are well protected by the redundancy and the layering that exists in the design of the spacecraft. The very large particles are being monitored, every single one of them being monitored by our ground observing installations. And if there's a need, we could take evasive maneuvers to be able to avoid any collision. It's a problem that we will have to continue to deal with as it comes. Well, it certainly doesn't fade. Every one of these adrenaline rushes is just as powerful as the previous one, maybe even more powerful, because you know you're taking a chance, and how many times are you going to do well, and so every launch is just that one little bit more exciting than the previous one. It doesn't get blasé. I personally love being up there. Every bit of time that I'm on orbit is just delightful for me. I enjoy it. I love watching the Earth from space. And we just become very conscious of the entire dimension of the whole planet. And we end up being the most strongest ecologists that you can think of when we come back. That's usually the message that we try to bring, is the importance to protect the one and only spacecraft that we humans have, in which we travel. And we are, as John Young says, he's one of our most senior astronauts, is that we are a civilization with no redundancy. So we cannot afford to lose this spacecraft that we have.